Well, our fun night continues. Rosemary Ellen Guiley with us, of course. She is our co-author in Talking to the Dead and has written a number of other books. And we're going to be talking about hauntings and spirit communications in just a moment when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. Rosemary Ellen Guiley with us, leading expert in the paranormal, metaphysical, spiritual field. She has authored more than 50 books, including, of course, Dream Messages from the Afterlife, The Encyclopedia of Angels, The Encyclopedia of Dreams, Talking to the Dead as well. Rosemary Ellen Guiley back on Coast to Coast. Hello there.
Good evening, George.
Looking forward to this. Happy Halloween, by the way, Rosemary.
And you too. And I am in the Mecca for Halloween for the next several days. I'm in Salem, Massachusetts.
Ooh. What are you doing out there?
I'm doing a Black Mirror scrying event for Contacting the Dead tomorrow night, and then I'm going to the Witch's Ball and doing a book signing.
Are you dressing up?
Of course. Wouldn't be Halloween in Salem without a costume.
That's right. So what is Rosemary dressing up as?
A wench.
I'm not going there. That's funny. So, Rosemary, Halloween, it's a great time. You know, it kicks off what I call the greatest season of the year. People like to get scared. Why?
People like excitement, and ghosts and hauntings are mysteries. They're part of the unknown. They're things that can come out of the dark and startle you. They involve contact with the dead, lingering traces of lives that were lived, and also of entities that don't really belong in our physical dimension. This stuff is around us all the time, but at this time of year, we seem especially close to it. And in fact, ancient peoples had ceremonies for honoring the dead at about this time of year, when they believed that the veil between the worlds was the thinnest. And so we really continue that tradition today with our parties and celebrations, scary movies, ghost walks, and things like that.
What creates a haunting, in your opinion?
There are a number of things, and the most obvious are people who lived and died in a spot. But actually, nobody has to die in a location for it to be haunted. It can be haunted by people who, for example, lived in a place and really liked it or had perhaps a traumatic event that happened there. They didn't have to die there, but it could have been very traumatic and unhappy, and they left an imprint or residue behind that sort of lingers in psychic space. And if the right people come with the right attunement into that place, then they can pick up on these traces from the past. But one of the most surprising causes of hauntings are the living themselves. And I run into this all the time, where people actually cause hauntings. They seem to have a connection to the spirit world. And it's like they're a beacon. And if they go to a place that has the right land energy or the right history, events that have taken place that have left these memories in psychic space, and they bring their energy into that, they can actually light things up and have hauntings, haunting activity that goes on. So the living actually may be part of the cause in some cases. Burial grounds, active land, holes between dimensions. I think a lot of this activity comes from the spirit world that's tied to the earth. And there are places around the planet where these openings occur, and spirits and the dead, other beings, they can come into our dimension, and we perceive them in ghostly form. So there are a variety of things that can cause hauntings.
Last week, I was talking with Joshua P. Warren about Robert the Haunted Doll, this hideous-looking creature that's down in Florida, about how objects could get haunted. Whether they're possessed or some curse is placed on somebody through it. But you are also a strong believer that objects can be haunted, aren't you?
I am, and I've run into this my entire career where an object has been the cause of hauntings. And as you know, John Zappas and I wrote a book called Haunted by the Things You Love. And did that show with you back in August when came out about all these weird things that can acquire spirit energy. If someone owns an object and they have a great emotional attachment to it, their memories, their emotions can be absorbed by that object, and the object then becomes haunted. A person who acquires that object could have activity in the house, maybe even feel the presence of that person, even acquire some of their personality characteristics if it's something to wear. Spirits can attach to objects. And we have spirits around us all the time. Spirits can attach to people. And then sometimes those attachments can be transferred to objects. And the spirit may be very quiet and dormant for a long period of time. It gets acquired by the right person with the right energy field and moved to a new environment. And it's literally the genie out of the bottle, because all kinds of activity can break loose. Many times it's not very pleasant for people. They have nightmares. They see dark forms and apparitions, cold spots. They might hear voices or other kinds of ghostly sounds. And it's very intrusive and until they actually do something with the object. Strangely, dolls, or maybe not so strangely, dolls really are one of the primary the kinds of objects that acquire these kinds of spirit energies, I think because they're substitutes for human beings.
Aren't these objects dangerous?
They can be in some cases because people react differently to these kinds of activity, and sometimes the activity can be very intense. And so people can have their health affected. They can have disrupted sleep. They start to feel watched. They get paranoid. It disrupts their entire life cycles. We had one case from one of John's files about a haunted mirror that was put in a dining room. And the husband experienced all of the haunting activity. The wife did not, which is not unusual. Oftentimes in a house, there's a single focal point that seems to get the brunt of the activity. But this mirror seemed to be a doorway for these dark shadow beings, and they would come into the house, and whenever the husband saw them, they reacted to being noticed, and they would rush back into the mirror. He also started having nightmares where these shadowy beings were warning him not to trust friends and family members. He began to have this foreboding feeling that something dreadful was going to happen to him. And even after the case was resolved and the mirror was disposed of, his marriage broke up. And then after that, he was killed in a very tragic accident. And it seemed that this warning was for him, that something bad was going to happen.
Everything seemed to fall apart for this guy, huh?
It did. And we've had other cases, and I've seen this over the years, where the spirit that's attached to the object with the right person can transfer itself to another host, another human being. And these entities need energy to manifest. And they can take that off the living. It's almost kind of a vampire effect, where they use a person's life force energy and even emotional energy in order to act out. If it's a hostile kind of spirit, then the target person can be in for a really rough ride. Sometimes it's just a matter of removing the object that causes things in a house to stop. The spirit doesn't have the same environment anymore, and it also can be bound to an object so that it doesn't create disruption. But I find these sorts of factors in a lot of hauntings. We have a real mix of things in many cases. It's not so simple finding the cause of haunting activity. There may be these residuals from the past, tragic accidents, active land, maybe some burial sites in the area or certain properties in the soil that help to create a battery for haunting activity. We have spirits that are interested in people attached to objects. And sorting all that out can take some time.
Rosemary, do you find that there's a common denominator with ghosts and spirits? Do they do similar things?
Yes, they do, George. There are different levels of hauntings, and the lowest would be this residual kind of haunting, where they're just sort of remnants left from the past. And the typical things would be cold spots, footsteps that sound in parts of a house or a building where no one is present, taps on the walls, maybe even banging sounds, apparitional shapes, especially if they're seen in the same place at the same time. The shadow, for example, that always walks down a hallway at a certain time. It's like a memory playing over and over again. And these are very common in a lot of kinds of hauntings. And then you have the next level up, which is where things are more interactive. It's like whatever is present knows that people are around and is trying to get their attention by disrupting things for them, by touching, pulling on hair and clothing, maybe even actually physically being able to have contact with a person, bedroom visitations, creating a sense of the person feels like they're being watched all the time. And spirits can actually masquerade as ghosts of the dead, and I think that accounts for a lot of hauntings too, where there's a place in the land, and so whatever is built on that land, that becomes a home for a spirit. And if the right people come in and occupy that that structure, then the spirit may be able to interact with them. Some of these beings seem to be interested in just having a little bit of fun. Mm-hmm. Others seem to be very hostile, and they want to do things to harm people.
Is there a bewitching hour? You know, we've always heard midnight might be one of them. But are there certain times in the day or night that these spirits pop up?
Almost unfailingly, we get the most activity between 3 and 4 a.m. And that's for me right now. I'm here on the East Coast. And so we're talking in my witching hour. And
I keep failing. You awake all the time, don't we?
And I'm staying in a very haunted hotel, too, the Hawthorne. So there are apparitions that are seen in the hallways, and some of the rooms are very active. But between 3 and 4 a.m., and I also see another kind of little side window until about dawn, which, depending upon the season of the year, could be around 5. And then sometimes a little earlier in the evening, like around 2 o'clock. But the core hour, 3 to 4, I think that has to do with our cycles of sleep. We go in 90-minute cycles of dreaming throughout the night, and the body's energy levels ebb and flow throughout the night as well. So there may be something about our state of consciousness that most people are in at about that time that encourages a lot of this activity. And the nighttime hours are very still, and so this is why a lot of ghost hunters like to do all-night vigils, because things get very quiet. It's easier to perceive phenomena. And then at these hours, when the spirit world seems to be able to be more active because the physical world is quiet, then the activity kind of bumps up in intensity.
Now, you've done a lot of research, Rosemary, into the spirits, and I want you to tell us about some of your research, and what have you been looking for?
The emphasis of a lot of my research in relation to spirit activity is in this interdimensional area. When I started out in the 1980s doing ghost investigations and ghost hunts, I was struck by the fact that a lot of these things happen in pockets of activity where there was a lot of intensity and ongoing that you could document going back in time, experienced by a wide number of people in a wide area, and also involving other things, not just ghosts, but other reports of things like lights in the sky, UFO craft, mysterious creature sightings like a Bigfoot and Dogman and other weird things roaming around in the woods. It seemed like certain areas were hotbeds of all kinds of activity. And if you can trace the history back on these areas, you find that these stories go back in time, and they're really part of the body of folklore that has existed since people came to live in those places. So there seem to be some sort of interdimensional tears that enable the spirit world to intrude on our world. These things seem to really share the planet with us. Spirits, the doorways also can be used by the dead from the afterlife. They're around us all the time, but we don't really interact with them except under unusual circumstances and in places where these boundaries are very thin. So I have documented those over a long period of time, looking for explanations as to what's going on this planet and how and why we experience these things only in certain places and sometimes under certain conditions. There also are patterns related to people. And I call them trigger people because wherever they go, things seem to light up from a paranormal activity perspective. It's though they've got something in their energy field that interacts with all of this unseen stuff that's around us. And it's like putting a match to something combustible. And if they go into the right place or the wrong place, depending on your perspective, then things get stirred up. These people have long histories of paranormal activity. It usually starts in a very early age with visitations. There's often a woman in white figure involved from an early age. They may have experienced abductions, more unusual activity than most people. They might be mediumistic and be able to contact the dead. And so if you put these right factors together, that can really create a very intense haunting. Meanwhile, in other places, the activity seems to be dormant a lot until something stirs it up. And Salem, for example, is a very good example of that. A lot of the hauntings here in town are related to the witch trials from the 1690s. And those were intense events. High emotion, people being tried and executed, hysteria in town, and that left this enormous imprint on land that the Native Americans said was cursed in the first place, that no one should live there. And those residues still resonate today. There are parts of town that are very haunted. The buildings, the shops have all kinds of activity in them. Some of the park areas around town and, of course, the burial sites still have that activity today.
Now, with what's going on in the spirit world and so many people realizing that they've got after-death communications, and as you and I know, and when we collaborated on Talking to the Dead, Rosemary, there are incredible things going on out there. So we're going to get into that when we come back with Rosemary Ellen Guiley, Hauntings on Coast to Coast AM. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, Linda Moulton Howe, our investigative reporter, will be with us with some incredible stories of high strangeness, and then, of course, Friday, Ghost to Ghost here on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to come back in a moment, more with Rosemary Ellen Guiley, and next hour we'll take your phone calls with her right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Rosemary Ellen Guiley with us. Rosemary, when we did Talking to the Dead together, and, of course, the research pointed out that there were ways to communicate with the other side, why do you think they want to communicate back to us?
Some of the dead have messages that they want to get to the living. They want people to know that they're all right. They might have a particular message for a particular person. They will answer questions about their lives, about how they died, about even things in the afterlife. And we can communicate with them through through mediumship, through using technology. I've been fascinated by the ability of different kinds of equipment that seem to encourage or facilitate or enhance communication. The disembodied need some sort of energy to form words, and sometimes equipment can provide that by making sounds like background sounds or radio scan, and we can have real-time two-way communication. And those devices continue to improve. But there's a variety of reasons why they want to communicate, and sometimes it's to help us to understand what goes on beyond physical life, what else is out there, what some of the other realities are like. And for some of us, it may help to prepare us for that transition.
You've got some great Halloween stories here, and let's give you some highlights, and then you could fill them in for us, Rosemary. Tell me about this bat that crashed a stage production of Dracula.
Oh, this is a funny little story. I was in Galena, Illinois, recently, which is an old river town on the Mississippi, and it's got quite a historic district. River towns often have a good haunted history to them. There's something about the energy of water running through a place. But I met a man who had grown up there, and he said that when he was a youth, he was involved in a stage production in town for Dracula. And there was one scene where they had this artificial bat that they bobbed out on stage. And on the first night of this production, they get to the scene, and this artificial bat bobs out over the stage, and a real bat flies out of the rafters and starts swooping around on the stage. Well, the audience loved it. They thought this was planned, and the bat didn't fly out over the audience. It just swooped around on the stage, and when the scene was over, the bat left. And it just seemed like a really weird coincidence. Well, the second night of the production, same scene. Artificial bat bobs out over the stage, and then this real bat comes out, flies around very dramatically. Once again, the audience loves it. It's almost like this bat is trained. It comes out on cue. It leaves on cue, and it never goes out over the audience like it's erratically flying around. Well, there were four productions of this play, Dracula, and after the third time, it happened again. The bat flew out just on cue. Well, this was kind of alarming because nobody could figure out where this bat was coming from. No one had ever seen a bat in a theater like this. And it was coming out on cue, but everyone was worried that the bat might fly out over the audience and really scare people. So they tried to get rid of the bat. They tried to find the bat, get rid of it. One of the things they did was to bounce balls around on the hard floor. The bats will be attracted to the sound, and they'll come out and follow the sound, and then they can be swatted at. No bat. Bat does not take the bait. On the final performance of Dracula, everybody now, because the bat's famous in town,
sure,
everybody is in anticipation of, will this bat make his final appearance? The artificial bat comes out in the scene, bobs around on the stage, and for just the briefest moment, there's no real bat, and everybody starts to get really disappointed. This hush falls on the audience, and suddenly he appears, makes his entrance, swoops around on the stage, literally upstaging the artificial bat, and flies out, never to be seen again.
I love it.
Stage struck
right on cue. That's perfect. That's perfect. The story about the dinner guest at a haunted home in Connecticut.
Well, that's our home. We live in, my husband Joe and I live in an area that's renowned for being haunted in really kind of a benign way. There's an old mining preserve not far from us, and mining areas are associated with haunting activity. Folklore talks about how spirits use tunnels and caves as access points to the physical world. And we occasionally have activity that comes through a house. It doesn't seem to stay very long, but it passes through. But we've had this drop in dinner guests. We have a formal dining room, and every now and then we like to put on a dinner party, and we get out old crystal. We have crystal and china from the turn of the 20th century, and there's a spirit that likes this and shows up. When we have these kinds of dinner parties, we'll see this spirit in the house. It watches us while we fix the food and get everything ready. There was one night when we had some paranormal friends over, and I told everyone that we had this drop-in dinner guest, and could they pick up on it? And as soon as I had made that announcement, we heard a bell chime, a phantom bell chime. It was as though the ghost was being recognized. And the spirit has identified herself as a woman. Her name is Josephine. And she lived during that turn of the 20th century, and she seemed to be attracted to all of the things that we were putting out. I guess we have haunted china and crystal. And so she shows up and has dinner with us when we have a dinner party.
You, of course, were one of those with me when we were thinking about doing the Ouija board show. There was you, Bruce Goldberg, and Jordan Maxwell. Jordan totally opposed. Bruce on the fence. You thought I should have gone ahead with the Ouija board experiment, if I remember correctly. Remember?
Yes, I do. Quite well, George. And at the time, yes, I was all for it because I thought it would dispel a lot of unreasonable fears that people have that the Ouija board is a bad instrument and it will automatically lead to things like possession. People do have strange experiences and sometimes horrific experiences with the board, but it really is a neutral tool. But the way the whole event went, I think it was good that we didn't, because such a hysteria built up. And the closer we got to the show, people were panicking and calling in and,
oh my God,
you know, don't do it. We were going to create all kinds of problems. So it's probably just as well we didn't.
You have had some Ouija board stories. You've investigated something about some vampires in a Ouija board. What happened there?
This was a case in Connecticut, and this was one of the weirdest Ouija board stories that I've investigated. It involved a group of teenagers, mostly girls. They were all high school age. They got fascinated by the Ouija board, and it's often the case, there's this trigger person. There was one girl in the group who was very interested in the occult, had done some reading, other kinds of spirit activity, probably had some mediumistic ability on her own, she became the focal point for this invasion of spirits who called themselves vampires. Now, the girls were fascinated by vampires, and spirits will masquerade and shapeshift to suit people. And so when they started using a Ouija board, they got a lot of results. It was very exciting, and they wanted to communicate with vampires. They thought that would be really cool. So these spirits answered, and they called themselves the Vampire Choir, and the dominant spirit said his name was Devin. Devin and the Vampire Choir. And they were very entertaining at first. This is always how it goes. The initial spirit contact is charming, witty, funny, can provide accurate information to get people in deeper, and that's exactly what happened. These girls started using the Ouija board more and more. They became obsessed with it to the point where it started taking over their lives. There's always a crossover point when things go downhill. And the spirits then go from being very nice to being very nasty and manipulative. By then, they've got their hooks in people. And that's what happened with these girls. The vampires started to be more manipulative, like they were attached to the girls. And they said the girls could never get rid of them. It didn't matter if they used the board or not. They could never get rid of them now. They were attached, and they followed them everywhere. They knew where they were all the time. Poltergeist things started erupting in the homes of these girls. They had nightmares. There would be apparitions, a sense of being watched all the time. The spirits also started issuing these dire warnings that if you don't do what we tell you to do, you know, bad things will happen. We can kill you. And they stopped using the board. They started to get very paranoid. They felt followed at school. They couldn't sleep at night. There were bangings and thumpings going on in the house. They felt literally like these vampires had taken over their lives. Devin said that we watch you all the time. There isn't anywhere you can't escape from us. They stopped using the board. They put it away. It didn't help. By then, the spirits were well attached. So all the phenomena kept escalating. They tried foolishly. They tried doing some rituals, some banishment rituals to get rid of the vampires, and that only made it worse. What happened then was the group of friends split up. It just blew apart all of the relationships, and they stopped associating with each other. Individually, they still had problems. These spirits attached to each one of them individually. One of the girls who was very badly affected went through some exorcisms, several religious exorcisms. These were Pentecostal. And she said the exorcisms were as grueling and as difficult as the attachments from these vampiric spirits that were literally vampirizing their life force energy. It took her several years and several exorcisms to finally be free of this attachment. And after she got out of high school, the friends stopped contact with each other. She had no idea how well or poorly they had fared, but she felt for most of the rest of her life, up to the time that I had interviewed her, that she couldn't do anything involving the occult, that all she had to do was dip a toe back in the water, so to speak, and this would call them back in because they still had a line to her. They knew where she was. She couldn't sleep well at night. She said, I have five dogs, and I have five dogs because I want some sense of protection, even though I know that it's not really protection against spirits, but it makes me feel more protected at night. So here's a person who had a lifelong problem as a result of being attached by Devin and the Vampire Choir when she was in high school.
I don't blame her for tippy-toeing around, too, but aren't these dogs... You know, don't they hightail it off with them when a spirit shows up?
Sometimes they do. It depends on the energy. I've done quite a bit of research on shadow people, these dark figures that can invade bedrooms. That's their most common characteristic, is they invade bedrooms. And they look like solid dark shadows, usually tall men wearing what appears to be like a coat or a cape and sometimes a hat. And if these entities have a very heavy, oppressive energy, animals will react, and oftentimes they will leave. They will get very frightened, and they will leave the immediate area where these things manifest, both cats and dogs.
Tell us about this terrifying wailing woman in the time we've got left this hour.
I've got a lot of research in West Virginia, and this is a very creepy estate from a lot of occult activity.
It sure is.
And in the back hills, people experience all sorts of things. And I spent some time in a remote area where they had a lot of activity, and one of them was this wailing woman who would come around the house in the middle of the night. Now, the local beliefs were that this was almost like some sort of banshee figure, and you didn't open the door. If you heard her banging on the door and crying for help, do not open the door because bad things will happen to you.
It's a trick, too, isn't it?
It can be a trick, yes, because that's how the spirit gets in. There is something about a threshold that some of them need to cross. And so they had these episodes in the middle of the night, living out in this remote country area, where in the middle of the night they would be awakened by the sound of a woman sobbing outside the house, begging to come in, just this horrible wailing and crying, and banging on the door. And if no one responded, the banging would increase, and the banging would sound on the roof as well as on the door and around the house. And these heavy, thudding footsteps would walk around on the deck outside the house. Now, they were terrified to even look outside, let alone the door. And the wife told me that on one occasion, the husband decided that he was going to go out and investigate. It just got to be too much, and she had to beg and plead with him, do not open the door. Bad things will happen to us. It goes on all night, this wailing, horrible wailing, thudding footsteps, banging on the house. And at dawn, it suddenly disappears.
Oh, those are creepy. A lot of these stories are creepy, Rosemary.
They really are, especially if you're in the middle of it yourself in a remote area. There seem to be things that have the upper hand on you. And many people will feel at the mercy of something unknown.
Have you ever felt threatened or scared on any of your investigations?
I certainly have felt unsettled and startled. I have stayed over in haunted bed and breakfasts and hotels where things have come into the bedroom, presences have come into the bedroom and plunked down on the bed. You can feel a weight come down on the bed. That's pretty unsettling. Some of these shadow people figures can get very close. They throw off a lot of malevolent energy. And the thing is that one of the things that frightens people so much is the unpredictability of it.
Yes.
You don't know what it
is. The unknown. That's right.
You don't know what it is and what it can do.
The unknown scares a lot of people, doesn't it?
It does, and rightfully so. There are many things that are benign. They just startle people. And everyone has a different boggle point, you know, different threshold. And what freaks out one person is going to be perhaps even entertaining to someone else. But I've investigated plenty of phenomena and cases where people have been truly terrified by what has manifested from the unseen realms. And some of it does seem to have hostile intent. It's not all benign.
Let's take some calls with Rosemary Ellen Guiley when we come back for the final hour with her on Coast to Coast AM. We shall be right back.